In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Betches Media presents.
Madam Speaker. Madam Vice President.
You want to hang out with us? You get your vaccine.
And so I went to Human Resources.
There's some things I just can't tell you on air.
The Betches Sup Podcast.
A woman's problem, if you will.
Hello, I'm Amanda Duberman.
I'm Sammy Sage.
And this is the Betches Sup Podcast, where C-SPAN meets the group chat to help you process and laugh at the biggest topics in U.S. news and politics. We are so excited to be here. We did a lot of fangirling before we clicked record, but we're here today with Alyssa Mastromonaco, who I just had to scramble to write an intro for because I was like, everybody knows Alyssa Mastromonaco.
You guys.
So my very short intro is that Alyssa Mastromonaco is, of course, the former deputy chief of staff for President Barack Obama. She's a two-time author, and she's the host of the Hysteria podcast and part-time YouTuber on the Crooked Media channel. How's that going?
Hi, guys.
We're so thrilled. We're such huge fans of you and Crooked and all of your books, every word you've ever written or said. So no pressure.
Shut the fuck up. I love you guys. I love your Twitter. I love your Instagram. I love it all. Okay. So we're just going to have a mutual admiration society going on today.
I also think we have like a little bit of like a kindred spirit habit wise. Like I'm a Grateful Dead fan. We appreciate a little bit of ganja from time to time.
And I mean, yeah. You guys, and it's like, I don't love the ganja because of the dead, but I mean, one does go well with the other.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, there's just, you know, I enjoy watching you bottle like jams.
Oh, make my jam?
Yeah.
Oh, you guys, I was doing it first thing this morning. Yeah. I've got something new on the stove.
Oh, wow. Incredible. What a tease. And my first question, super important question. How's the new kitten?
Oh my God, she's got the shits, you guys.
Oh no.
She's literally, before I signed on with you guys, I was on the PetSmart website just Googling cat digestive. She's going to the vet next week. But yeah, she's got the shits, but she's adorable and they all. So she was the inn is now officially full. Though my husband's like, my husband's like, stop saying things that may become a lie. And I can't help it, you guys. It's like the world is so terrible that if I can at least like save a cat, I mean, I have enough space, so it feels like the right thing to do. But I'm always very scientific about how you introduce the cats to each other. So they are, they love each other.
Oh, wow.
Like, they love each other. They like all love each other. They the three of them love each other more now that she's here. She's she's like this little 7-month-old, one-eyed Persian kitten. And the oldest cat, Petey, he's 14 and a half, kind of like, he's my love. He's an old fucker. I love him so much. And he's just like, I am digging this because now Norm, who's the rambunctious 4-year-old cat, has a best friend to play with. And Petey's like, let me put my ginks up and just enjoy my time on this earth.
Oh, man.
Honestly, you lucked out there because I had a cat when I was like in high school or whatever. And we introduced an additional cat thinking like, oh, they'll be friends. This will be great. That didn't pan out really. So
and you just got like
there was just a lot of resentment from the older cat about the introduction of the younger cat that really never went away for her whole life. So it was upsetting.
But your cats are used to having new siblings, like especially the oldest one.
Yeah, poor Petey. This guy, he was like, we thought at first that he was meant to be alone. And then this rescue called me on Good Friday, right before Easter, and asked me if I wanted to rescue a cat named Bunny. Like, what the fuck? How do you say no to that?
Yeah.
And the truth is that Bunny really brought Petey out of his shell. And so after that, I was like, look, if it goes tits up, you know, we'll have to rehome her through the rescue. And that's like, it's better to try and fail. You know?
Absolutely. You gave her home. Yeah. You would have given her home. Mostly. My dog has a paralyzed esophagus and I just applied to adopt one with 3 legs. So we'll see.
Oh my God, I love that.
When's that one going to
come? I don't think I'm going to get him. And I honestly don't think we're ready, but it's a dachshund with three legs. And I just really want to name him Slug because he looks like a little slug.
Oh, but let me tell you something. Animals are just so resilient that when it's like, I mean, I've had cats with all kinds of problems and they just like keep on going. They're like, fuck it, man. If I were in the wild, I'd have to figure it out.
So. Especially because like, I'm going to love my pets. I'm obsessed with them anyway. So if I've got a little bit more, if I've got that much love to give, give me a dog with one leg. Give me a dog with paralyzed stop.
Oh my God, you guys, we're literally kindred in all the ways.
Yeah. So speaking of, we have a lot of political questions for you. Very highbrow.
Let's do it.
High level questions for you. But our first is, as a Loyal Hysteria listener, I knew that you were very like 420 friendly, but I think I always assumed that that was like a post White House pastime. You just sort of like present as like a goodie, like a high achieving person who maybe came across that late in life. But then reading your book, I learned you've been an enthusiast for a long time, predating your White House years when you did have to stop. And you've been pretty vocal on your podcast about how this government policy is outdated, stigmatizes cannabis use. Yeah. Big flipping the bird to the policy. You've even pitched yourself for Biden administration weed czar, which we endorse. Yes. We're happy to lead that campaign for you.
Guys, they just need to give us an office and a dream, you know, that's it.
And like, you know, some substances.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, whatever the DEA will let us study. But so how did you react? Did you know before Obama won, or did you know that that was something that you would have to deal with, that this policy existed before you got to the White House?
No, you guys, it's actually pretty hilarious. So my whole life, I mean, I've smoked weed my whole life, since high school.
We're literally all like the same person.
it's a big compliment to us.
Yeah.
Thank you, guys. And I, you know, it wasn't until, so what happened was it's October 2008. And what you find out in the government is that you have to plan for all outcomes. So in October 2008, the Bush administration starts clearing both Obama people and McCain people so that their clearances would be done, or at least interim clearances would be done by the time we take office. And so you have to start that process early. So one of my dearest friends, who shall remain nameless because I don't know if he wrote about it, comes back and is like, look at this document. And we're like, what? It's like your clearance form. It's no big deal. He's like, look at this question. And I was like, wait a minute. Marijuana is considered a drug? Legit, you guys. Legit. I was like, wait, really? Like, cocaine, I get. Acid, I guess. I mean, but like mushrooms, no. I mean, to me, it's like this shit comes from the ground. It had never occurred to me. And so I went home that night in Chicago and I flushed my weed down the toilet. And I didn't touch it again until a couple weeks after I left the White House. But the interesting thing, and why I am such a champion of this being accessible to people, is that what I realized is that when I went cold turkey and stopped with weed immediately, my body reacted, not in like a withdrawal situation, but like all of a sudden my IBS was back, you know, and worse than ever. My anxiety, I had to manage in a different way. I mean, I've read books on this and I kind of don't love the way that it's positioned, that like some people like me can in some circumstances thrive because of their anxiety, that it makes you hyper astute, you know, executing, you check every box, you dot every I, you cross every T. And so I did, I think, effectively turn it into a good tool, aside from the IBS. And I just started drinking wine, you guys, I gained weight. I mean, it's like, I was like, what the fuck? And I didn't drink a lot, but it was like, you know, a glass and a half at the end of the day, just to take the edge off.
Right.
And, you know, over the course of those, however many years, you know, there were periods where I had to use Xanax and low dose Xanax. And I was like, what the fuck? And so the minute that I got out of the White House, I was like, did I make this up in my head this whole time? And so I went back and I found my weed and I was like, oh my God, this should be legal for everybody. I feel so much better.
Honestly, like I always think about like what, like wine and alcohol, like I feel like they're now showing are so much more like toxic for the body than marijuana and like Xanax. I mean, people grow dependencies on that. Big pharma's making money off of it. It's
so
just,
much money.
Yeah.
And you know what? I had hangovers and still do. I get them. I call sadness hangovers from Xanax.
The worst.
where the next morning you're like, why am I so sad?
Yeah.
Why am I so, oh, I took Xanax. Oh, what am I going to do? Because today I'm so sad.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah. And it's like, I still over the years have taken Wellbutrin and Zoloft, but the truth is that when I need to deal with something quickly,
right.
Weed is the way to do it. And it doesn't mean that you're fucking tripping balls and high off your ass.
You know? Exactly.
Like, it's just, that's the beauty of the moment that we're in, is that like, you can actually dose it properly so that you just feel better. Not that you are like literally second set, almost encore at a dead show.
Yes. Especially drums in space.
Like, exactly.
I'm like sitting on the floor like, this is nice.
Right. I know I've gone through that. I feel like I've gone through this with like therapists too, where they're like, you know, see if you can find other ways to manage your anxiety. I'm like, I can. This is just by far the best.
Right, I'm like, yeah, there are other ways, but meditating doesn't work. Taking deep breaths doesn't work. When I was just away and we had to take COVID tests to get back into the country, obviously. And we had like home tests or whatever that ultimately didn't end up counting because we didn't like do the telehealth thing, but whatever. So I had to wait for 15 minutes waiting for it to like finish. And I was congested. So I was like, oh my God, what if I have COVID? I'm going to get stuck here. How am I going to get back? And during that 15 minutes, I was like, okay, I'm going to actually try those techniques that they say will reduce anxiety. Like breathe in this amount of times and breathe out this amount of times. And I tried them like so in earnest. And when I tell you my heart did not stop beating out of my chest, like nothing, it didn't do anything. I'm like, how do people seriously say that like meditating is going to take you to like,
some people, it's a tool that works perfectly well.
Some people, it does work.
Yeah.
It's true. I will say I've gone into the Calm app.
I love the Calm app. Yeah.
You guys, I'm very into it. Yeah. I'm into it. It's like Kate Winslet reading me a Christmas story about Thomas the Train. I didn't think it was going to do what it did. It's like, I'm just like, you know what? I'm just going to drift off. This is so great. So anyway,
you know what makes it even better?
What? Weed.
Yeah, I know.
Yes. I've been trying to actually like take a little bit of a breather from it, no pun intended, but, and the breather happens to be this week. So this is a great conversation for all of that, but I have not been sleeping as well. And when I ask myself every morning when I'm looking at the clock, 3:45 a.m., why am I up when I never used to wake up? I think we now have our answer.
I mean, it is to me, it is a helpful sleep aid. Betty's nighttime Eddies are.
Oh, yeah, I've had those.
Yeah.
I got it.
Endorsement.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are just as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They're milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
So, pivoting a little bit. So I recently listened to the second,
okay.
Which is a delight. Yeah. And so whenever you read them, obviously your former boss, President Barack Obama, he comes up a lot, but what I love about reading your books is he doesn't come up necessarily in the places you'd expect. He comes up in sort of random places as you're talking about life lessons. I believe there's one particular anecdote. I'm not sure if it's in your book, but you told it on the podcast where you've talked about how President Barack Obama made you realize you don't need to wear uncomfortable clothes and shoes. Is that right?
That is correct.
How did that, can you recount that for our listeners?
So it's actually pretty funny because when we first got into the White House, and I don't know how long it took, but there was a blog that used to criticize what some of us would wear. And I felt, I'm just going to be very honest with you guys. I felt like a real responsibility. We were representing the first Black president of the United States. I didn't want to be some broke ass staffer who didn't bring shine, you know, who brought embarrassment or anything like that. And so one day I'm in the Oval Office and you guys, I wear my emotions all over my fucking face. And he's like, what's wrong? I was like, nothing, I'm fine. And he's like, what's wrong? I'm like, well, you see, there's this blog and it says that we're, you know, we're disrespectful and that, you know, we, that Republicans, you know, Republican women wore pantyhose and skirts, and we wear pants and no pantyhose and blah, blah. And we wear clothes that are too casual. And he was like, okay, let me ask a question. Why do you wear the clothes that you wear? And I was like, because you and almost everybody else is a fucking gazelle. And I can't keep up with you if I wear high heels and pantyhose. Give me a stomach ache. And he was like, so then if you work better the way that you are, and I don't care, why do you care? And I was like, what? And he's like, yeah, why do you care? And so we had a pretty...
'Cause I'm a woman.
I know. And I'm like, I don't want people to think bad about you because of me. And he was like, oh, they have other reasons to think bad about me. And so after that, and then it was a couple years after that. And I, part of my job as deputy chief is that I oversaw natural disasters and terrible things that happen in this country. And so during Hurricane Sandy, I actually slept at the office one night, I think, but mostly I was just like up at 4 to bed at midnight. And one day I lost track of what day it was. And I had on J. Crew corduroy pants and a puffy vest in the office. And like, no one said anything. And I was like, let's see how far I can ride this train, like, you know? And I eventually did go back to more normal clothes, but no, he's like, if you, and this is something that I have taken with me for the rest of my life. I will never wear clothes that make me feel uncomfortable in any way. And I am more creative and collaborative. I mean, look, when you're hangry because you're trying to not get that rollover between your underwear and the top of your skirt, you know what I'm talking about. And you're like, oh, I'm so hungry, but I'm so bloated. What am I going to do? When that vaporizes and is no longer a part of your thought process, you're like, I am literally free. And so I like to live free. And that's
Did you ever even like, I find I'll even anticipate discomfort from my clothes. I'm like, oh, I have a meeting tomorrow that I know I have to dress up for, and I'm going to be uncomfortable and nervous, and you couldn't smoke weed.
Right. No, I did. And there were outfits that were sort of the go-tos. You know, I had a shift dress that was, that didn't require control top anything. And so the shift dress was usually my go-to for dodgy days.
Yeah. Did the president ever give you any bad advice? This can obviously be very low stakes.
Oh, did he ever give me bad advice? Not really. We just had like a source of disagreement about food. That was our, we used
what was
to,
your disagreement?
Oh, you guys, he loves like super healthy food, like super healthy. And once
it's just like a salmon, like every meal, right?
It was a lot of salmon. There was a lot of salmon, and it was like salmon and quinoa. And he was like, why aren't, maybe I gave him advice. He's like, why aren't you eating it? And I was like, because it's not going to taste good. And I'm not wasting calories on something that's not going to taste good. And he was like, Alyssa, food is fuel. And I was like, I live to eat, not eat to live. Like that's, and so that was sort of mine. Now I am a fairly healthy eater, but like not.
Right.
Of course he thinks that, cause he wasn't like a woman in the 90s when like everything was like snack wells, low fat.
Snack wells were
devil.
I mean, like, it's like, that was so bad for you. It was so much. Like,
they were really bad
sugar.
For you.
They
was terrible. But I think they taste great.
They do. Some of them do. I like the vanilla cookies, the vanilla cream cookies. Those were good. But like the chocolate devil food cookies tasted literally like fake sugar and nothing else.
No, completely. But you would eat like a sleeve of them because.
Pretty much. Because you're like, oh, these are good for me. And they like, we're not.
No,
completely.
I just have to ask, like, generally, what is it like to be like on such close terms with Barack Obama?
Okay. So here's the thing to remember. You have a very different vibe when you've known each other for like a long time, right? So he interviewed me for my first job in the Senate early mid-December of 2004, right? So by the time we get to 2014, it's like there were these really funny moments. Actually, so here's prior to Barack Obama, I had worked for John Kerry for several years, including on his presidential campaign. And so when I started working for Obama, I always called him Senator Obama. And one day he called me into his office. We were still in the transition offices in the Senate. So it was probably like January, February 05. And he's like, can I ask you a question? I was like, yeah. He's like, have I upset you? And I'm like, no, why would you think no. He's like, will you call me Senator Obama? It's so formal. It's like, you're mad at me. And I was like, here's the deal. I've actually been in the Senate longer than you. And I know that if some young person like me, I wasn't even 30 at this point, is calling you Barack in front of like Ted Kennedy and Bob Byrd and these like lions of the Senate, you know, like they're not going to, I have to show respect and like for them to understand that we respect you. So they respect you. And he's like, I guess that's a fair point, but let's make a deal. You call me Barack in private and in public, you call me Senator Obama. And so I was like, fine. And, you know, those times we traveled together a lot because I ultimately became the political director of his political action committee. And you guys, it was just hilarious. Like all the time we'd be like in the back of a car with a volunteer driver. And there was this guy who I would travel a lot with, Jordan. And we loved to sing. And one day the senator, then Barack, was like, must you? And we were like, okay, never mind. And we stopped singing. And then after like 5 minutes of awkward silence, he's like, all right, fine, sing again, Jesus Christ, you know? And so we had like a lot of real deal good times. Like he was involved in my relationships and like we would kind of-
Well, I thought that he did give you some bad advice about a relationship. I believe in, so here's the thing, he encouraged you to maybe stick out a relationship that-
Yeah, he did.
Had not
he
been
did.
Working.
He
yeah.
did. And you know what, though, is that I did stick it out and I'm not sure.
Okay.
No, I'm
so
not.
So you can't blame him.
No, I can't. Well, no, but it actually ended up not being good advice per se. But because I stuck it out by the time we broke up, I was convinced that there was nothing that was going to make it better. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But no, when he became president, he was president-elect and we were in the transition offices in Chicago. I'm like the queen of protocol. I know that you're looking at me with my bandana and my gray sweatshirt on and you're like, okay, Alyssa. But the first day that we were in the transition office, I went around and I briefed everybody. I was like, when he comes by, you call him president-elect and you stand up. And so he comes in and everyone stands up and they're like, Mr. President-elect. And he's like, oh, did you do this? And I was like, it's the right thing to do. And so, you know, there were... We made it through some stuff. So it was, he is a lovely, fun, funny person. And the one thing that I will always say is that there's nobody more curious about anything than Barack Obama. It's like, he wants to know what you're reading, what you're eating. He sees somebody, he's like, what's going on with you? It's something I didn't realize was such an important trait until our last president. When I was like, oh my God, he's literally curious about
no
nothing.
Curiosity.
Like, nothing. Yeah. It's like, he's
never
president.
Had a question.
And he doesn't care how the government works. And so like, you know, it became something that I always like to tell people about because I think that people should know. People think that the presidents are so smart, they don't have to be curious, but he was curious about everything.
Can I ask, like, is he a good texter?
We never texted. We emailed. And he was always, he's always been sort of funny on email.
Okay. That's good. I wonder if he texts at all.
I was, you mentioned those like volunteer drivers. I was a volunteer driver for the Hillary Clinton campaign in 2008. I'm sorry. It sounds like that was more fun to listen to you guys sing, but I remember just thinking it was so, I was like, how am I driving her around? I'm 19. It was like in South Dakota, but it was actually one of the best experiences of my life. It was so cool.
No
to be able to
campaigns
do that.
Can do it without the volunteers.
Yeah. Yeah. They called me an intern, but like I was a volunteer. They were like, sure, you can say it was an internship.
That sounds like so much fun. Like
it was fun.
I love to drive. Well,
so you, as we have discussed, you've worked for an actual president and whose lines are like, I guess the president sometimes, I don't know if this is accurate to say, but maybe they sort of inhabit like the mainstream moderate perspective of the party or a mainstream one. But on Hysteria, you regularly advocate for things like ending the filibuster, judicial reform, the stuff that we really need to do. I'm curious if your personal political views have changed since your years in DC, or if you're just more at liberty to discuss them now, or if you just feel more of a, have your political views evolved, or have they always been this way and you're just more at liberty to say?
So here's the thing. I dance between pragmatic. I feel like I'm pragmatic and progressive, I guess is the way to put it. Like I understand, and this is something that, you know, we have to remember that now looking back, we feel like Barack Obama was a bit more moderate than people
now. Yeah.
At the time, I mean, he was like fucking healthcare, you guys. That's like, and here's the thing he said, and I remember, I'd rather be a one-term president and get this done than play it safe just so I can have a second term. And so for me, I mean, you guys, I got into politics because of Bernie Sanders. 1994, Burlington, Vermont, baby. I was like, who is this man? And I had the...
You drove him around, right?
I did. I drove Bernie around. And I had the good fortune of understanding. So here's something I think that we all overlook in discussions. There is public service and there is politics, right? And so what I loved about Bernie is that to this day, the one thing you want to be able to do is trust your public servant. I don't think Bernie's ever fucking lied. People may hate what he says, and he may, he will not shy away from it though, if it's what he believes. And they have largely been his views for 40 fucking years. And so I have always believed that we should have, I mean, you guys, this is what's so fucked up about the discussion right now, is that Republicans are like, all this socialism. And it's like, fucking socialism. The United States is second from the bottom of the world in how we treat our families and in paid leave and how we treat our mothers and our children. And so like, we should be talking like we're catching up with the rest of the globe, not like accepting this premise that this is fucking socialism. But I think that, you know, there are just fundamental things like the prison system just needs to be fucking reformed. I think that when we know more, we should do better, right? And I think that all the things that we've learned over the past 10 years are like super eye-opening. And so I think I've always been pretty progressive. I, when I was in the White House, took being a public servant very, very seriously and felt that I was there to represent all the people in America. And just like, you know, Barack Obama said the first day in office, you don't work for me, you work for the American people, all the American people. And so, you know, I think that I just never saw it as my place or appropriate to be super political those years when I was in the White House. But when we left, I mean, I ultimately left, like, I mean, Donald Trump, when Brett Kavanaugh happened, that's when I was like, I need to be like a freelancer. I need to not be tethered to a company, because the things I want to say, I shouldn't put a company in the position to have to defend me or anything like that. You know, I mean, once I tweeted something, it was my first viral tweet. when Donald Trump told people that no presidents had called the families of those killed in action, which is like such a personal thing. It's one of the hardest things a president will ever do. They've all done it. And I literally called him deranged. I said something crazy, and it was on like,
or accurate.
I mean, it was totally accurate, but like my face and my tweet was up on all the cable shows and like the morning news, like network news, like CBS. And I was like, oh my God.
Crazy.
And after that, I was like, I can't put companies in a position. And that's when I decided to strike out on my own and do a lot of work with NARAL, because then came Brett Kavanaugh. So I think that we spent a lot of years thinking that, yeah, we have to do things with climate change. Like, it's really bad. And we have to protect Roe, but we didn't really ever think Roe was in this kind of jeopardy. And now the chickens have come home to roost. And so it is important to be more vocal than we probably ever were, I think.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I tend to like let the moderates and Republicans like set the parameters. So like you said, these progressive issues, they're just what other countries are doing. But when like the mansions and cinemas are like, but we could never possibly, what a radical idea to end the filibuster or reform the judicial system. It's like, these are kind of some of the only,
you know,
paths.
The thing about this too, is that like, I understand, look, people represent their states, they represent their constituencies. I have a hard time thinking that a good portion of people in West Virginia and Arizona wouldn't benefit from the things being discussed as potential policy items in this reconciliation bill. So that's when it starts not feeling on the level, you know, and you get a little
Okay.
Also, you know that if Republicans controlled the House, the Senate, and the presidency, they would be shooting their shot, you guys. This would be, they're like, we're fucking going for it, okay? They weren't like, oh.
We would be wearing Handmaid's Tale dresses
without
if they had, yeah.
Question. And so it is very frustrating to see, you know, two people potentially standing in the way of all of this really positive change. I mean, who hates free community college, you guys? Like, why?
Right.
We can only afford more weapons. We don't have room for community college.
No, we need more buttons on for the Defense Department.
I do think what I think your point about thinking of yourself as a public servant versus a politician is kind of like the break in like philosophy of, I would say, like the Gen Z newer kind of like representatives who are getting, you know, like the more younger people who are getting elected. Whereas like you have the Republicans and some moderate Democrats who like they've been there so long and you can tell that like they're playing politics. There's like someone's hand is in their pocket with money. And like, that just feels like so, it feels so like old and outdated retro, and just like retro. And we need, like, we're never going to solve a problem like that. Like maybe that could work in like the 90s before the planet was about to die, like in 5 minutes. But like now we need people who are public servants, like looking out for the most amount of people possible and just like taking action. Like I can't even like express how frustrating it is to watch people do absolutely nothing. And like, oh, we just can't get Manchin and Sinema. Like, can't they figure it out? Like from your experience, like why can't they just figure it out? Like why can't the Biden White House just get them to like do it? Like what's the issue?
So I am not sure. There are a lot of things that I have been confused by potentially. So for example, I feel like Manchin and Sinema didn't have to come out 2 weeks ago and say they weren't for $3.5 trillion. Like when you start laying that, because here's what happens. They come out and say that. They don't say, here are the policies I'm for. Here are the ones I can't support. They just make it about a number, right? And so by doing that, then the American people are like, well, wait, what's wrong with $3.5 trillion? And it sets up this conversation that's like just not super on the level. And, you know, I feel like, you know, back in the day, you know, my full disclosure, my husband was Harry Reid's chief of staff for many, many years when I was in the White House. And Harry Reid's big thing was like, just keep your powder dry. Just fucking don't say anything out loud. Just let's give ourselves the space to figure it out. Because once you've gone out, so like now that's, here's the thing to think about. Now that Sinema and Manchin have gone out and say, I can't possibly support $3.5 trillion. Well, or how are they going to get to a place where they can support it, right? It's like, it's like now the room for negotiation is public. And I think that it's when it's private is that it's when it's able to figure out. But also, I think that if they listen to people, I had the honor, truly, of interviewing Congresswoman Cori Bush from Missouri. And I think the big lesson, I think she's one of our best public servants. And the thing is, she has, guess what? I absolutely will listen to everything she says about evictions. She's been evicted. And she knows what she is talking about. Guess what? She worked at a daycare and got promoted, but still couldn't afford to send her kids to the daycare. So literally on every pandemic issue, she's been a frontline worker at some point. And so do I care what someone who has barely been back to their district in years thinks, or do I care about someone who is literally explaining life experiences? And I think that's part of the problem, is this detachment from people who've been in DC. Being a senator should not be a retirement plan. You know,
like you shouldn't be getting a wine internship from like some hedge fund because you're like during your senatorship. Like you should be working all the time.
I was confused by that. I'm going to admit I was confused by that story.
It feels like they never work. Like it's weird. Like it feels like Congress is never working. And it's just sort of like the 24-year-old staffers who are keeping things like barely going.
Well, you know, there are. It's an interesting thing for people who are listening. Whoever your congressperson is, go to their congresspersonsname.house.gov website and check out their schedule. Yeah, check out. So for me, it's delgado.house.gov. Antonio Delgado works his fucking ass off.
Yeah.
He is all over the district. I have seen him so many times. One of my last public events before COVID was going to a town hall in Churchtown for Delgado, where I was like, who are all these anti-vaxxers? And then I was like, oh my God.
Oh no.
When COVID happened, I was like, oh shit, this is going to be a problem. But see what they do, you know, hold them accountable. There may be people, like, here's the thing. I don't believe in throwing the baby out with the bathwater. If there are people who have been in Congress for 25 years, but have been hustling for 25 years and have been current for 25 years and are like keeping up with the times and working their ass off, great, more power to them. But if you're someone who's like, I've only got like 5 more elections until full retirement benefits. Like, no, totally. No.
Right. Yeah. That's what I appreciate kind of about Chuck Schumer is that like, there was like a whisper of like, what if AOC ran? And now he's like, you want weed? What else can I do for you?
Look, it's an interesting thing about the progressive cause. Like, you know, I was a vocal Cynthia Nixon supporter when she ran for governor against Andrew Cuomo.
It is very interesting to think about what might have happened if she had won.
And whether or not she was going to win, she was forcing a conversation to the left. And that's important. And we wouldn't have gotten a lot of things in the past couple of years, I think, if she had not run against him and forced a conversation and for people to then hold him accountable and be like, whoa, you said you were for weed being legal. Where are we at? And so I think that also it's just like never anything but upside to have good contested elections.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to ask you a couple more questions about, I guess, your time in the White House and how you can help us frame this White House as you've been doing.
Sure.
I was curious if there was like ever a moment so far in the Biden administration, this is two questions, when you thought, wow, that would have been a really fun day to like have my old job and to have been there. And then on the other hand, what's a moment when you thought, this is exactly what I hated about it. They must be miserable. I would not want to be there today.
I have to be honest, you guys, I have not coveted their days since they took office. I mean,
they won.
Not one. I mean, it has been a nightmare. They walked into so many problems, you know, big ones. Not like I can silo this one and hive it off and go deal with this. I mean, so many problems. I think the worst day, what was the worst day? I mean, the past couple of weeks have not been great.
Like, they have not been good.
Like,
yeah.
The day when it's like COVID is spiking, we're getting the vaccine booster. No, we're not getting the vaccine booster. The withdrawal from Afghanistan. Regardless, I think I'm going to speak. We needed to leave Afghanistan. It's hard to imagine, but I'm not there. So I want to be very clear. I'm clearly not there and I'm not talking to people about it. It feels hard to say there wasn't maybe a slightly better way to withdraw from Afghanistan. You know, I mean, those pictures are hard to watch. And I think that when people in the administration are talking about it, you really have to lean into the fact you know how fucking bad it is and not really lean on the like, it was always going to be this bad, because I think it's hard for people to believe that. Even if it's true, I just think that that's like, you know, but I saw, you know, I've known Jen Psaki, I have known since we were little tiny babies on the Kerry campaign.
Oh, really?
Oh, I've known Psaki for forever. And I just watched her go up to that podium and I was like, girl, prayers. Like this, like it is just because also it's like the media. Look, we need a free and fair media. But like you had Trump for 4 years. So let's stop trying to pretend like the Biden people are like as dishonest in any way that he was, because that's just fucking ridiculous. But you know, it's not great. It's hard. It's hard. And this is like, I don't see when it's gonna finally get easier for them, you know.
No.
Right. Yeah. Was there anything like when you were working in the White House that outsiders, whether it was like friends or critics, would always give you advice and they were like, you should totally do this, or why don't you do this? That like now that you refuse to take. Yeah.
No. So it wasn't even so much refuse to take. It's that, you know, the one thing I will always be cognizant of is that times change. And things are different. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so we had a lot of people who would be from former administrations, specifically some former like Clinton people, who'd be like, you guys really need to get out of the White House and you need to do like these big events, like sign a bill at the Grand Canyon and all this stuff. And I'd be like, okay, guys, first of all, our events are very pretty. One, two, that's all fucking pre-9/11. Shit changed after that. Okay. Because guess what? If a president goes to the Grand Canyon, no one can fly over it for a very long time. And, you know, you know, an interesting thing looking back, which I always kind of like to talk about, is that we all remember how bad Hurricane Katrina was and the pictures of Bush in the flyover, and he was criticized so roundly for that. And then we got into the White House and we came to understand, not excuse, but understand how that happened. That everybody, that so it was August, so many people in the White House were on vacation. That the circumstances on the ground were so bad, you never would have wanted a president to land and take resources away. And we would have criticized him had he not done the flyover, like if he had just stayed in Washington. And so it's like, I do try to always remember, and the Bush people were very kind and very generous with their time when we transitioned in, and they said, look, we're not defending what happened, but we're saying that the systems had gone untested for so long that it would have happened to somebody. And it was. And so yeah. After that, we had, you know, one of the deputy chiefs always had to be on campus, always had to be at the White House, you know, because we were the organizing. If something happened and everybody was gone, it was like Alyssa gets a conference call together is like, boom, boom, boom. Here's what we're going to do. You do this, you do that, you do this. We're going to reconvene in 4 hours. Don't send, you know, superfluous emails. And which is literally how you deal with any crisis, essentially. Yeah. Just stop stray voltage emails and just get people to do their shit and come and report back. But that, you know, I feel for them. I feel like they have a long year into the midterms ahead of them.
Just something you alluded to about how like the press is not necessarily treating, you know, the Trump administration and the Biden administration with the same, you know, level of harshness. What do you make of like the general asymmetry between the two parties in terms of power and like what we're able to get done? And like, how do you think Democrats can overcome that?
So I think that I think that Republicans unite and will toe the party line, right? It's like they don't have, like I just said the word stray voltage, they don't have a ton of people who are like, oh no, oh no. I mean, like Trump ruled belligerently with an iron fist, and they were able to get things done because they literally just towed the party line. And Democrats are much more of a big tent party, and we welcome all kinds of ideas. I mean, it's almost like sometimes I laugh. I'm like, we're almost like the British Parliament, you know, like the Democratic Party unto itself. It's like people are mad at each other and they're like, you know, there's also something I think that is a bit performative. Republicans definitely have it too. But I think that like on social media, sometimes it's like, sometimes everyone should just step away from social media, stop doubling down, stop saying crazy shit, yeah. Stop alienating people in your party. It's like, just be quiet. Everyone, no one's going to vaporize if they're just quiet for a little bit and figure things out. And there's definitely time for outrage, but I think sometimes everyone would benefit from like stepping away from the Twitter for a little bit.
Yeah, no, I mean, I feel like even in like, we're sort of hybrid. We're in between, you know, press and media. Yeah. And it's like, sometimes I have found enough times where when I have felt pressured to make a sudden statement, I almost always regret it. And if I just be quiet, totally. Nobody will be like, remember that time a year and a half ago where they didn't say anything about this. It's like, no, but they'll remember if you said the wrong thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. We've taken up so much of your time. So you've been so generous with your time. So thank you so, so much. What else, are you up to with Crooked Media, where people can find you?
Oh, let's see. So I can be found on the podcast Hysteria, wherever you get your podcasts. On Twitter, I'm at AlyssaMastro44. And on Instagram, I'm at Mastro175. And so come. You guys, it's awesome. Here's the thing. Going into midterms, we should do this all the time, don't you think?
Okay, I would love that. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, like, I'll do this like, anytime. For real. You're so fun to talk to.
For real. And I hope when next time you're in the city for a long period of time, our new Betches office just opened.
Oh, no,
yeah, wait. We'd love to
have it. Oh, my God. We'll talk offline about where it is because I can't wait. But yeah, you guys, this is, you know, like, I don't know, make me your political commentator. Perfect. Who cares? Let's do it.
You hear that, John?
Yeah. Thank you. You guys, let's figure some shit out.
We got to figure it out. It's up to us. Thank you so much. Until the end of democracy, I'm Amanda Duberman.
I'm Sammy Sage.
And this is the Betches Up Podcast. Bye.
The Betches Sup podcast is produced by Amanda Duberman, Jorge Morales Pico, and Sean Kilby. Editing by Jorge Morales Pico. Social media by Amanda Duberman. Be sure to follow at Betches_Sup on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And send us your emails to suppod@betches.com. Betches.